Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Your Call, we continue our week-long series discussing President Obama's legacy by focusing on the environment. Yesterday, President Obama pledged $500 million to a UN climate fund intended to help poor countries fight climate change. During his tenure as president, Obama used his executive power to create monuments 29 times and placed a record 553 million acres of federal lands and waters under protection. That is more than any other president, including President Roosevelt, the founder of the U.S. National Park System. President Obama's Clean Power Plan set the first national standard for power plants, the number one climate polluter in the United States, according to the Environmental Defense Fund. Through the 2009 stimulus package, he invested billions in clean energy technology. In 2015, after environmental activists and citizens spent 4 years marching and rallying across the country, he rejected the Keystone XL pipeline. In September, the United States and China agreed to the historic Paris Climate Agreement, and last month, he banned drilling on federally owned land in large areas of the Arctic and the Atlantic Ocean. But oil and gas production soared during his presidency. Obama approved more than 1,500 offshore fracking permits in the Gulf of Mexico. According to Inside Climate News, on his watch, the U.S. surpassed Russia in gas production and Saudi Arabia in oil production. Joining us today to talk about President Obama's environmental legacy are two guests. Mae Bouvie is executive director of 350.org, a global grassroots climate movement that holds leaders accountable to the realities of science and the principles of justice. Mae is co-author of Fight Global Warming Now, and she joins us from Brooklyn. Hi, Mae. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Matt Keller, National Monuments Campaign Director for the Wilderness Society. That's a conservation organization working to protect the country's shared wildlands. And Matt joins us from Durango, Colorado. Hi, Matt. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Mae, I want to start off with you. In 2014, we often heard that Barack Obama embraced an all-of-the-above energy strategy. In fact, according to the White House website, the U.S. is producing more oil and natural gas, generating more electricity from renewables. We often heard Obama say that he wanted to embrace an all-of-the-above strategy. So looking back over the last 8 years, how do you assess his environmental record?
It's a really important question because we're asking it at a time when the impacts of climate change are being felt so severely around the world. We're just getting reporting today about more temperature records being broken. And, of course, what that means for people is an entire change in the kinds of things we depend on from nature, from reliable weather patterns to being able to farm without drought to an ocean that actually can be hospitable to sea life. So that's the context in which we're asking this question. Given that, it's without a doubt that President Obama has considered climate change a critical part of his legacy, and a lot of the decisions that we're seeing, even in the past couple of weeks, demonstrate that he wants to be seen as a president who took this issue on, because history will judge leaders at this moment. But it took a lot of pressure. It took a lot of pressure from movements to get to this point. And I think that's part of the story that has to be told, is that a lot of these decisions came about through relentless organizing and activism. And as the president has made perfectly clear, he wants to be pushed. He wants us all to be organizers. So I think the climate movement certainly did that over the past 8 years. And there's now, thankfully, a good amount to show for it from the examples you mentioned. And, you know, we're also particularly keen to look at the political impact of these decisions, because we're talking about a battle between the fossil fuel industry and the public. And each time we have a movement victory, like stopping the Keystone XL pipeline, like the Clean Power Plan, like stopping the Dakota Access Pipeline, this builds political power for our movement for the fight ahead. So it's also important to consider his legacy along those lines.
Matt, what would you add? What about that? You know, a couple of years ago, environmental journalists would say Obama's environmental policies are kind of erratic. They're all over the board. On one hand, he embraces renewables. On the other hand, he brags about U.S. oil output. But as May said, I mean, the Keystone XL activists were on the streets for the last 4 years. And then in North Dakota, I mean, Standing Rock was another major victory. Of course, we're not sure what's going to happen with that. But the fact that the Army halted the pipeline was a massive victory for Standing Rock. So what are your thoughts on that? In the last, you know, year or so, Obama really hasn't bragged about U.S. oil output like he did a few years ago.
Well, I'm not an expert on oil and energy issues, but I will agree strongly with May's point that, you know, anything good in this regard only happens because people care and get involved and engage and organize on this stuff. It certainly has been the case with the progress this administration has made on protecting public lands and in doing that to some extent through a climate lens. I think it's remarkable, not only sort of the position they got to by the end of the administration, the list of accomplishments they've achieved, particularly, you know, given where they started out, which was not being particularly geared towards the subject matter. But I think a good case was made for lots of issues, including protecting our nation's public lands and making them more accessible and open and inclusive to Americans of all backgrounds. So, that doesn't happen without really strong civic engagement. And I think every good achievement we saw accomplished over the past several years was a direct result of that type of outreach and organizing.
And Matt, what do you think are the major environmental achievements of the administration?
I mean, you pointed out a great one in your lead-in. This administration has protected more land and water than any president in history. 29 new national monuments, expansions to five others, 2.5 million acres of wilderness, 1,000 miles of wild and scenic rivers protected. You know, the list goes on and on. That's the frame. I approach this work in my area of expertise, and, you know, from that perspective, the achievements are significant.
Give us a couple of specifics. It's hard to even keep up with all of these because he created 29 national monuments 29 times over the last 8 years. And then, as you said, he's expanded protections for 553 million acres of lands and waters. What really stands out for you?
Well, a whole lot of places. I live in Southwest Colorado, and there's a pretty amazing landscape just over the border in Utah, about an hour from where I live, called Bear's Ears. That, to me, is one of the most significant national monument and land conservation achievements of this administration. I think it's particularly special because it really wasn't just about land conservation. We had five sovereign tribal nations that were actually leading the charge on this initiative and asked the president to protect these areas that are sacred to them and to their ancestors, and are just amazing wealths of cultural and archaeological resources, and just hold, you know, really special significance for these tribal communities. Beyond that, you know, Bear's Ears is just an absolute haven for wildlife of all varieties. Really important in a dry and arid environment, for protecting precious sources of water. And, you know, for Americans who like to experience and enjoy the outdoors, it's really world-class in what it offers in terms of camping and hunting and fishing and hiking and all the things that we like to do in these places. You know, as you mentioned, there's a long list of monuments. It's hard to reference all of them. I think, you know, the flip side of this is that, you know, in addition to protecting, you know, all these terrestrial monuments, significant work was done to protect ocean habitat as well. And, you know, a recent expansion to the California Coastal National Monument probably drives it a little closer to home for some of your listeners. Just the other week, the president expanded the entire California Coastal National Monument by, you know, protecting additional sites along the California coast. But looking at, you know, areas like the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts off the coast of New England, the recent withdrawal from oil and gas development in the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans really shows some of the amazing amazing achievements that this administration was able to do. You know, quite frankly, when Congress refused to act, the president stepped up on numerous fronts and exercised his executive authority to do the right thing and to protect wildlife and to, again, you know, help to create a system of parks and public lands that's more inclusive for all Americans.
We actually did a show a couple of weeks ago when President Obama created the largest protected place on the planet in Hawaii, just off of the, in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. This area is now twice the size of Texas. I wanted to just ask you quickly, going back to Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, you mentioned the five Native American tribes that were involved in this, including the Hopi and Navajo, and I understand that these tribes are going to offer management input for this monument for the first time ever through an intertribal commission. Is that right? And how significant is this?
That is right, and it's extremely significant, and I think it's a recognition of, you know, the important role that Native Americans have and should continue to have. And increasingly should have, you know, in our public lands. You know, this is an unprecedented tribal commission, and I think we'll have a much better national monument because of the tribes' input on this. So, you know, there have been other sort of similar initiatives, but really nothing is powerful and significant. And, you know, again, I think it'll be, you know, just looking for, you know, the experience that, you know, any American who wants to visit this monument will have, I think it'll be just so much of a richer experience because of, you know, the traditional knowledge from tribes that will be really highlighted in the management of these landscapes. So it is significant, it's historic, and I think, I hope, that it creates a model for other places in how Native American tribes and communities can engage in public lands management.
And I've read that the Bears Ears Monument in Utah and the Gold Butte Monument in Nevada are among some of the most contentious areas that federal protections have been expanded. Why? Why are they so contentious?
Well, you know, in Utah, we have, you know, a state congressional delegation that, quite frankly, is not particularly friendly to conservation and doesn't like the fact that the federal government owns land and or manages land for the American people, I should say, in their state. You know, even beyond being against use of the Antiquities Act, they're against the notion of the American public having these lands in their state. So that's not a great starting point necessarily. You know, I will point out that you know, the state's congressional delegation, led by Congressman Rob Bishop, actually had introduced legislation to protect the Bears Ears landscape, roughly about the same size, you know, kind of footprint that the Obama administration ultimately protected. You know, it would have put into place, you know, similar levels of protection for Bears Ears. It would have done a whole bunch of other things that are really bad and would contradict bedrock conservation laws, and we certainly didn't like that. But at the end of the day, nobody was in disagreement that the Bears Ears landscape shouldn't be protected. They just didn't like the fact that they weren't able to get it done and pass legislation, and the president stepped in and did it. On Gold Butte, I don't know that I would really characterize that one as controversial, quite frankly. The new House member who represents that area, Reuben Kuhn, supports it. Senator Harry Reid advocated very strongly for protection of the area. The local communities in Mesquite and Las Vegas, Nevada, were supportive of that designation. And most of the polling that I saw showed, you know, over 70% of the state's population supporting that. You know, are there a few, you know, vocal critics of public lands protection in general in Nevada like there are in Utah? Absolutely. But I think it would be a stretch to call that one controversial. And I think, you know, looking at Bears Ears, you know, there's strong support across the state despite the congressional delegation's pushback on that. And, you know, add to that, you know, the piece I already mentioned, you had five sovereign tribal nations that actually supported this and proposed it and have tribal members, you know, in Utah, in surrounding states, in the Four Corners as well, that strongly supported that designation. So it's tough to find a conservation issue where you have 100% consensus off, you know, across the board. But I think both these landscapes were so important for so many reasons that the administration, you know, recognized the significance and did the right thing. And I'm glad that they did.
Matt Keller is National Monuments Campaign Director for the Wilderness Society, a conservation organization working to protect the country's shared wild lands. And President Obama used his executive power to create monuments 29 times, and he placed a record 553 million acres of federal lands and waters under protection. We're also joined by May Bouvy, Executive Director of 350.org, a global grassroots climate movement that holds leaders accountable. May is co-author of Fight Global Warming Now. And today we are continuing our week-long series looking at President Obama's record. Today we're talking about his environmental record, and we'd love to hear from you. It is a very long record. So what do you think overall of what Obama did or didn't do to protect the planet, to protect wildlife? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you work on environmental or climate change issues, what concerns do you have about what we are now facing? We're going to talk more about that a little later in the show. In fact, Scott Pruitt, Donald Trump's pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency, is now involved in a hearing. He's answering questions right now. And so we'll ask our guests about that later in the show. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on Facebook or Twitter. So many things there. May, what about you? What would you say are at the top of your list when you think about the major environmental achievements of the administration?
One of the things we think is incredibly important from a climate perspective is the advancements around clean energy. And the president made significant progress in terms of how this country invests in clean energy during actually the economic stimulus, which was one of the single most significant investments in renewable energy ever made by a head of state. And when we're thinking about the most important steps to tackle climate change, that is obviously one of the most important, and it has tremendous amounts of other benefits, including creating the kind of good quality jobs that we know are needed for so many Americans. So I think a huge part of Obama's legacy will be looking at renewable energy. You spoke to it before, but we should take some time to specifically talk about the legacy of the Paris Climate Agreement, which is complicated because President Obama was also president during the Copenhagen climate negotiations in 2009, which of course did not deliver the kind of aggressive international agreement that the world needed then. Gratefully, there was an agreement reached in 2015, and certainly President Obama's efforts with China and other countries was vital to make that happen. Of course, that agreement did not give us everything that we would have hoped for, and if we look at the science around it, even if every single country does everything they pledged, we're still looking at an unsafe level of warming. So that's something that has to be said when we're discussing Paris, but of course, climate change is a global issue, so Obama's record on climate has to be seen from that lens.
Right.
And I want to take a little bit of time as well just to focus on the political significance of the pipeline decisions where the president weighed in, both around Dakota Access, Keystone, and there have been others. But these fights were chosen in part because they face huge amounts of local opposition and they're impacting people's daily lives, and particularly communities who are low-income Native American communities in the U.S. and First Nations in Canada. But these fights were not ones that where the odds were stacked in favor of the climate movement. Quite the opposite. And there was aggressive and intense lobbying on the other side. And, you know, when the Keystone fight really got going, every professional political hack in Washington gave it zero chance of being a successful fight. But, in fact, that's exactly what happened. And one of the things that made that possible is local, citywide, and national opposition. And as we look ahead to the disastrous consequences of the election, it's exactly that kind of organizing that stopped Keystone, that stopped Dakota Access, that preserved all of these public lands. That's what we're going to rely on. So we have to consider that as well.
Right. Now, you brought up clean energy, and Scientific American ran an interesting piece called Obama Has Done More for Clean Energy Than You Think. And the piece points out that as part of the Recovery Act, which you mentioned, the government agreed to take more of the financial risk for renewable energy projects, which spurred a stampede of applications. Can you talk more about some of these projects, and what are you watching closely right now?
There was a really fantastic conference right around that time when different leaders from cities and states came together to talk about what the stimulus funds could support in their communities. And it ranged from home weatherization and the incredible need to actually conserve energy and the huge jobs potential from weatherizing homes, to projects that would put solar panels on schools and churches, to the kind of refinements to the grid that we know make all of the kinds of clean energy projects we need go online. So what's impressive about the movement for clean energy is, I think, on the one hand, it gives people an opportunity to understand very visually, what does this energy transition actually mean? How will moving from fossil fuels to clean energy make my life better, make my family healthier? And that's exactly what some of those investments in local projects did. The other thing to keep in mind is that during the Obama administration, the price of solar dropped really precipitously, making possible a much faster uptake of clean energy policies all over the world. So we hope that that trend continues. It's likely that it will. And it's also producing tons of jobs as well. So it's really a positive story, and one that we need to actually keep telling ourselves, both because it gives us the kind of political momentum we need, and it's what the climate needs.
And why did the price of solar drop so much?
There were lots of factors, and some of it, and I think a large part of it, has to do with the technological innovation that we've seen in the industry, and really finding new ways of getting solar cheaper and getting it to market. And I think that's one of the biggest factors, but we have some fantastic leaders in the renewable energy sector. It would be wonderful to have a show just for them to tell the story of how this energy revolution is taking place before our eyes.
Today we are talking about President Obama's environmental legacy, and we'd love to hear from you. What questions or comments do you have? How do you grade Obama? The list of things that his administration has done is very, very long. A lot of people are not happy about fracking. He approved more than 1,500 offshore fracking permits in the Gulf of Mexico. Oil and gas production did soar during his presidency. But at the same time, May was talking about clean energy. We're also talking about the 553 million acres of federal lands and waters that are now under protection. We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. And before we go to break, Matt, May was talking, actually, you both are talking about the fact that organizing on the ground really pushed the administration to go against the Keystone XL pipeline and then also the Dakota Access Pipeline, at least temporarily. Matt, can you talk more about what you learned in the last 8 years about what really works?
I think, a few things. And again, to agree with the piece on organizing and the critical nature of that, I think, and this is a lesson I learned in working with this administration, that, inclusivity and diversity of voices matter in the political discourse. I think the more that we're able to demonstrate, benefit and support from a wide array of Americans on stuff like this, the more successful we're going to be. It was a really good lesson in kind of broadening the work and working, to really build a big tent and make, public lands and parks, as they should be, meaningful and relevant for all Americans. I really see that as being really a primary reason why, this work was successful over the course of the past several years.
Matt Keller is National Monuments Campaign Director for the Wilderness Society, and May Bouvy is Executive Director of 350.org. Today we are talking about President Obama's legacy on environmental issues and the planet. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion yet, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, right after Your Call, NPR's coverage of President Obama's final press conference. Half hour from now here on 91.7 KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we will continue our series looking at President Obama's legacy by focusing on immigration. Under Obama, more than 2.4 million people have been deported. That is more than his predecessors. At the same time, he created DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That allowed more than 740,000 undocumented immigrants who arrived in the U.S. as kids to receive a work permit and protection from deportation, at least temporarily. So tomorrow we will be talking about President Obama and immigration. And then we are starting a new Book of the Month Club, and we're kicking it off next Tuesday with labor activist Jane McAlevey's new book, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. And she asks, why do progressives keep losing on so many issues? Well, she says that in order to win, movements need strong unions built from bottom-up organizing, placing the power for change in the hands of workers and ordinary people. Jane will be with us next Tuesday, so we hope you can grab a copy of her book and then call in with your questions and comments on her book. And if you have a show idea or another book idea, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about President Obama's environmental legacy with Mae Boovy, executive director of 350.org and co-author of Fight Global Warming Now, and Matt Keller, National Monuments Campaign Director for the Wilderness Society. And I wanted to ask you, Mae, about another important move by the Obama administration. The EPA enhanced fuel efficiency standards for vehicles. According to the EPA, the final standards are expected to lower CO2 emissions by about a billion metric tons, save car owners fuel costs of $170 billion, and reduce oil consumption by up to 2 billion barrels over the lifetime of the vehicles sold under the program. Can you talk about how effective this will be and what your thoughts are on it?
Yeah, this was a fight that our organization was not as involved with as others, but I do know that it was a major priority for much of the environmental movement, and it has huge implications not only for the climate but also for public health, because cleaner cars are better for our health. They produce fewer emissions and fewer polluting emissions at that. So it was successful on a couple of fronts, and also, you know, going back in the time machine, was around the time of the bailout of the auto industry. So it was a way of capitalizing on a difficult situation economically and also making a significant climate contribution. So that's certainly listed by many as one of the biggest achievements that the president made. I do want to go back to something you were saying before, which is, you know, I started out by saying that all of this has to be looked at in the context of the seriousness of the problem with climate. Mm-hmm. And especially given where President Obama started from with, as you said, this all-of-the-above energy policy, it was very concerning and continues to be concerning to the climate movement and our allies that it looked like the oil and gas industry was going to get a pass. And so the automobile efficiency standards helped a great deal, but we still see an incredibly politically powerful oil industry, and that kind of regulation did not really concern them as much as we would hope for them to change their business model. I mean, in the past 8 years, we've also seen Exxon be under investigation by state attorneys general and retaliate by accusing those attorneys general and organizations like ours for compromising its right to free speech. So when it comes to actually addressing the problem of our oil consumption, yes, the fuel efficiency standards are to be praised, but we've got a lot of work to do to actually focus on reducing our dependence on oil and reducing our political system's dependence on the lobbying influence of oil.
Well, you mentioned Exxon, and Rex Tillerson left Exxon just a few weeks ago. He's been tapped by Donald Trump to be Secretary of State. He's already testified. According to some reports, Republicans are still on the fence on Rex Tillerson. Just one Republican needs to vote against Rex Tillerson, and he will not become Secretary of State. And then Scott Pruitt is testifying today to be the head of the EPA. He sued the EPA many times as Oklahoma Attorney General. He's a climate denier. The cabinet will be full of climate deniers. So, May, let's talk specifics. Will the Trump administration be able to reverse these fuel efficiency standards?
I think the Trump administration is going to try to do as much damage as possible because they know that their friends in the fossil fuel industry will suffer if these sorts of plans go through. So I think they're going to try to fight this as hard as they can. And in terms of the specific mechanisms, it really varies depending on the policy. Some executive orders are harder to change than others, but I certainly think that this administration is a where there's a will, there's a way administration. And if you look at the appointees, it's clear that climate is on the chopping block for what this administration wants to do. Now, the good news is that this is because there have been so many significant shifts in the past few years about how seriously the public is concerned about climate change and how much people want to see a transition off of fossil fuels to clean energy. So there's going to be huge opposition to the Trump agenda on climate, but we are under no illusion that they're going to try to keep any of these strong policies in place. And this is one way for the public to see just how opposed to caring for the future the Trump administration intends to be. And so we're going to keep focused on that. And each regulation, each law that was passed under the Obama administration, people are working very hard to determine just how well we can work together to protect them.
May Bouvy is executive director of 350.org, and now I would like to welcome Andrew Revkin to the show. Andrew is senior reporter for climate issues at ProPublica. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you. So you have written a number of articles asking these questions, what will the Republicans do? What really stands out for you? Based on the interviews that you've done, the hearings that you've heard, what Obama policies are under threat from a Trump administration?
Well, one of the pieces I wrote for ProPublica recently, and I've been tracking the hearings yesterday and today very closely, including just now. It's important to keep in mind that some of what we call a legacy under President Obama was achievements that were not really part of his policies. The reductions in greenhouse gas emissions the country registered since 2008 were mostly because of a shift away from coal to natural gas. That was not a function of him magically waving a wand. And I did this piece that, you know, those trends are even not within Trump's control either going forward, so that there are limits to what you can do with policy. In other words, we are slowly decarbonizing the American economy for many reasons, efficiency and new fuels replacing old fuels and renewables and wind coming on. You know, Rick Perry, Secretary of Energy, if he gets through the nomination process, as Hal Harvey. Hal Harvey is like one of the most strident, informed climate campaigners, energy innovators out there. And he said Rick Perry. When I interviewed him, he extolled Rick Perry's virtues as the country's biggest winner on wind for the policies he was able to do in Texas. So it's not quite clear what will come out the other end.
Hmm.
This morning in the hearing just now, Pruitt said the EPA should regulate CO2. And he and Ryan Zinke yesterday said global warming is not a hoax, directly contradicting those 2 or 3 year old tweets of Trump. So, you know, once they're in office governing and they're functioning, you know, you have to kind of wait now. It's kind of a weird process to wait, but as a journalist or a campaigner, I think. But there are possibilities of rational policy emerging. I'm not going to say it'll be a good outcome for the climate system, but it's there's some, at least some signals of a rational approach to the problem, maybe.
And Representative Ryan Zinke, the Montana Republican, was nominated to be the next Interior Secretary. There's so many things, so I just want to throw that out because it's hard to follow all of this. Well, we'd love to hear from you. We've got full lines, actually. So let's hear from Amar in San Jose. Hi, Amar. Welcome to the show. Hi, Amar. Let's try Paul in Palo Alto. Hi, Paul.
Oh, hi. What stands out in my mind is Obama's support for nuclear power. He started that at around 2010, and increasing loan guarantees, federal government loan guarantees, to anyone that wanted to buy to build a nuclear reactor. And he thought that this was a way to combat climate change. But I think that nuclear waste is the most toxic waste imaginable. Plutonium stays lethal for 50,000 years. Certainly terrorists would get a hold of it to build dirty bombs. So he also reduced the amount that a nuclear producer can be sued if there is an accident. So he did some very substantial things in legislation that is now on the books that makes it easier to produce nuclear power. And I personally am horrified by nuclear power.
All right. Well, thank you for that. May, do you want to take that one? Bloomberg had a piece a couple months ago that says states can take more credit for carbon-free electricity to be generated by nuclear power plants under construction as they comply with emission reduction targets set by the EPA. But the administration gave the struggling nuclear industry a glimmer of hope by allowing new reactors to count more toward meeting federal emissions limits.
Yeah, as we've been saying, it is a mixed picture, and we would love to see a full embrace of an energy transition that looks at renewable energy 100% of the time. And there have been great strides there, but not nearly what we would hope to see, and I think that's where we want to see the energy mix go. So I think the caller's right to point this out as something that isn't as ideal as we would have hoped to see.
Although that's a question that really divides environmentalists now. There were 70 of the world's leading conservation biologists signed a letter this a year and a half ago saying that without nuclear power, they see you can't be for conservation of and climate action and not and against nuclear power in a kind of like a blanket way. Governor Cuomo in New York State just kind of for the first time carried out what you might call a some nukes policy, where Indian Point, the reactors closest to New York City, will be closed down by 2021, but the upstate reactors in a struggling part of the state economically, they're helping to sustain. So having it have a role, it's 60% of the country's zero carbon energy right now is nuclear, and if you take it off the table, it makes any serious action on climate change just that much harder.
Hmm. Well, we should definitely do a show on this. We have another question from Henry about fracking. He says the administration focused on encouraging development of natural gas primarily by promoting fracking not only in the United States but around the world on the theory that gas was a bridge fuel, one that produced fewer greenhouse gases than coal or oil. Some scientists and big environmental groups support this strategy, but it was all based on an illusion that most people still have not grasped. Do you want to also take that one, Andrew?
Well, I follow the data, and this last year there were two or three really big studies on what's causing an uptick in methane. Methane is the main ingredient in natural gas. That when you turn on, if you turn on a gas stove, you're mainly burning methane. So, but it's also a greenhouse gas. So if it leaks out, that's a problem. And there's been a lot of legitimate concerns about leakage of natural gas from oil and gas facilities. But these studies, this past 12 months, three or four peer-reviewed studies, including by like Rob Jackson at Stanford, who's one of the leading people pointing to concerns, they show that the rise in emissions of methane in the atmosphere are coming from the tropics and mainly from livestock and farming, not from oil and gas.
Hmm.
So that says don't get too distracted. you know, by the thing of the moment. It actually, you might think more, or at least as much about meat consumption if you're worried about methane as and rice cultivation practices in the tropics as oil and gas. There's been a change since the data show that before 2010, 2012, there was the emissions in the atmosphere, and you can distinguish the two forms of methane. Seem to be more from oil and gas, but now it's more from livestock in the tropics.
Huh. Well, that would be... May, you want to jump in?
Yeah, the other thing that's interesting here is that during the course of the Obama administration, the whole understanding about some of the risks of fracking shifted a great deal, and there were, in particular, some studies, the Cornell study is the most well-known, about how the risks of methane emissions had been underplayed in previous studies around fracking. And so this was, I think, one of the issues that consumed the climate movement the most during the Obama years, because coming into it, there really was an understanding that fracking was necessary and gas was a bridge fuel, to now a almost complete about-face on that issue. And again, looking and taking a step back on the politics here, as Andy pointed out, you know, there's still a ton of reliance on natural gas in this country, and it is preventing the kind of wholesale transition and investment into clean energy that we would want. So I think where we saw some victories in the past 8 years, you know, some states like New York banned fracking after tremendous amounts of grassroots pressure, but it's hugely on the rise around the world, and it was, you know, Obama's State Department that really helped make that happen. So the fracking issue has implications not only here, but also all over the world.
Well, and talking about the meat industry, Donald Trump has yet to announce his pick for the Agriculture Department, which is very interesting. So that'll be one to watch. Thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Denny in Richmond. Hi, Denny.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for your show, as always. I was calling to sort of interject a note of reality from the environmental justice community. Here in Richmond, you know, with the Chevron refinery and all the refineries in Contra Costa County and our work all over the nation, I would really suggest that you would bring in some environmental justice experts, because the president's record on environmental justice is a disaster. He has not, his administration has not enforced the Title VI Civil Rights Act, which forbids corporations from engaging in anti-civil rights action in environmental justice communities. And across the board, we have suffered under his administration. And while we appreciate all the stuff that's been done for national monuments and conservation and banning in the Arctic, it's failed to protect people in the Gulf and environmental justice communities on a very bad level. And it's only going to get worse under Trump.
Well, thank you. He did approve more than 1,500 offshore fracking permits in the Gulf of Mexico and received a lot of criticism during the BP oil disaster. Dan writes in, maybe it's because the incoming administration is likely to be so much worse, but your guests seem to be dancing around Obama's complete lack of leadership on climate through most of his tenure. He's come around a little bit in the last years, but it's too late. Matt, what are your thoughts on that?
Is that for Andy or May?
Matt?
Sure. Yeah, it's not my area of expertise. And certainly with, you know, the climate emergency that we all find ourselves under, you know, more is always better in terms of what we can do to, you know, to accomplish, you know, reversing the effects of climate change. And, you know, it's... The environmental justice side of things is certainly concerning, but yeah, it's, to be honest, it's not really my area of expertise. I'd kick that question to May.
All right, May, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with both comments. I think that, you know, in some ways this conversation is about trying to see what has been useful and helpful, and I think we didn't start from the framework of what didn't work, and had we done that, we would have had a very different conversation. And absolutely, it took a ton of work to get some of the changes that we've started to see in terms of the climate legacy. And again, my main point here is if we look at how far we have to go from a climate perspective, from the very biggest picture internationally to the very local level, to communities like Richmond, who have borne the brunt of the fossil fuel industry's pollution and corruption and environmental racism, we see a very dark picture. So, and as the, I think the person who emailed points out, considering what we're looking towards, there is certainly an inclination to try to see some more positive to where we are and what we have to protect in the face of the Trump administration, but that doesn't take away for a second all the things we know should have happened and didn't under the Obama administration.
Well,
can I bring up one other thing?
Sure.
There's another kind of, if you want to look for, like, villains, one thing, and this comes up, and you were discussing just before I came on, the Obama's fuel economy standards for vehicles. We have to look at ourselves. This is every consumer, everyone who has a capacity to push for change and isn't. And just to get back to cars as an example, I've written a lot about this, and there's more to come. It was one thing for Obama to raise the standards for vehicles. It's another thing for that to translate into what's on the roads. And in America, we have this amazing habit. There's a guy at the University of Michigan who tracks this month by month, year by year. Every time gasoline prices go down even 5 cents, we move from buying a sedan to buying a light vehicle. And guess what? The light vehicle has better mileage than the older light vehicle would have had. Mm-hmm. But the effect on our emissions is nil. And this you look ahead, and it would take literally decades for the marginal improvement coming, even a significant improvement in miles per gallon in the standards. That only tells companies what to put on the lot. It doesn't tell people what to buy. And so It's really important to look in the mirror and look at our own lives and say, what are we doing to cut emissions that government's not going to help us with? And that has to be part of the picture, or this will slide forward decade by decade, year by year. And
yeah, it's so true as the population grows. And yes, we'll definitely add that to our story list. And thank you for our show list. Thanks for calling in, Denny. I did want you to know that Steve Early, the author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, which focuses on Richmond, will be on our show on February 8th. So I hope you can join us for that. Let's spend the rest of our time talking a little bit about what the Obama administration could have done. May, when you think about what he could have done but didn't, what's at the top of your list?
I think from the biggest picture perspective, starting off on the footing that if he wanted to make climate change his legacy, that could have been started from the get-go. And the whole nonsense around an all-of-the-above strategy set our movement's work back tremendously. And not just saying it, but the investment in expansion of pipelines and fracking that did happen. So I think if we're trying to win a battle of ideas here, that it's not too late to see dramatic action on climate change take place, but we've got to be on a massively mobilized footing in terms of the rollout of renewable energy. You know, that was a setback, and it would have been some of the things that we're praising today we could have accelerated dramatically. Hmm. So that's the number one thing that I would point to. And it was, I think, a misstep and gave the fossil fuel industry, I think, a bit more comfort at a time when their business model is cooking the planet and has to go.
And in terms of organizing, since you report on these issues, Andrew, we were talking about Keystone XL organizing. Environmental activists and citizens spent 4 years marching and rallying across the country. And then the Dakota Access Pipeline, I mean, that was incredible to watch. What are your thoughts on how organizing affected Obama, especially during the end of his presidency?
Oh, boy. I wrote about this at the time. I was an opinion columnist until I moved back to my role now in ProPublica as a straight reporter. And when the Keystone fight was percolating first time, Bill McKibben, my good buddy, and we've been at this in different ways since the 80s, reportorially, and he more as a campaigner, we disagreed on Keystone. And I thought at the time that it saddled Obama with an issue as he was fighting, the Republicans for that middle class in a way that wasn't going to change the overall climate picture, because oil has this habit of finding a market coming from a place, whether it's Nigeria or tar sands, and finding the market as long as there's demand. So we had, you know, we disagreed about that at the time. And, you know, how much Obama might have been hurt by, I don't, you know, no one knows. There's so many ways to say who got hurt, or, you know, how things might have been different.
Or why he acted.
The conversation was different. Yeah, you know, in terms of, just think about Hillary, too. This was, the same tension was around Hillary Clinton's campaign. Should they say something about Dakota Pipeline, or should they be silent? And, you know, and being pressed on that front from the left, even as they were fighting to maintain some support in the middle, you know, there's no way to calculate. There's so many things, you know, from the Comey letter onward that affected the outcome of this campaign.
Well, if you can answer this question as an op-ed writer, I mean, you're very closely connected. You cover these issues. What do you think will be most effective to take on the Trump administration that will be full of climate deniers?
Well, going forward, I think the important thing to look for is when you have congruence, when you have confluence. You know, if you have a Rick Perry in a state like Texas, that where wind is a significant success story, and you have Trump looking for infrastructure investments, and you have a grid that's aging, you can find a path toward a cleaner energy economy.
Hmm.
Looking, you know, for those opportunities, or you can fight the fight. And I'm not sure. It's all necessary. You know, everyone. There has to be a really careful look at how Pruitt's administration unfolds, how NASA's results. I wrote about NASA. You know, we may lose just the simple capacity to keep programs going that are understanding the climate system, let alone knowing what to do about it. And all that stuff has to be rigorously tracked. And that's what I'll be doing. But at the same time, we have to keep our eyes on the prize. If the prize is a sustainable human relationship with the climate system through this century, then the work is way bigger than that. It involves what Bill Gates is trying to do with R&D. Obama tried to boost basic government spending for R&D. Trump actually said that in his campaign. They issued a statement saying R&D is a vital underpinning of American innovation and needs to be sustained even in times when they're cutting other budgets. I mean, you know, hopefully there's some reality there. I don't know.
We'll see. Thank you. Andrew Revkin is senior reporter on climate issues with ProPublica. May Bouvy is executive director of 350.org and co-author of Fight Global Warming Now. And Matt Keller is National Monuments campaign director for the Wilderness Society. Thank you all for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up on tomorrow's Your Call, we'll talk about President Obama's legacy on immigration. Under his leadership, more than 2.4 million people have been deported. That is more than his predecessors. At the same time, he created DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So how do you grade Obama's immigration record? KALW produces Your Call. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Helena Murphy and Stephanie Porcel are our volunteers. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.